These days, everyone who has a mobile device can take great photos and shoot videos, showing up all the time on Flickr, Instagram, Facebook, and a host of other social media sites. You point your phone and shoot a picture. Sometimes it's a hit, and many times it's a miss. So what separates the amateurs from the pros? For over 125 years, Dodd Camera has assisted photographers, both professional and amateur, with state-of-the-art cameras, lenses, lighting and darkroom equipment, and class instruction. You can learn about new equipment from their blog or attend one of the many in-store events. The folks at Dodd Camera are helpful, professional, and experienced. They'll take the time to answer your questions and give you advice you can use. You may go to doddcamera.com to find out more. And finally, we wish to thank Dodd Camera for sponsoring the Outspoken Cyclist podcast.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for March 17th, 2018, indeed, St. Patrick's Day. This week, we begin in the States with my first guest, Jim Sayer. Jim is the executive director of Adventure Cycling Association and just returned from the annual bike summit in Washington, D.C. Jim and I have a talk about the summit, what's going on at Adventure Cycling, which is a ton of stuff, and then we briefly chat about the cross-country bike trip he and his then 18-year-old daughter Lucy took last year. We'll take a break, and then it's off to the UK to speak with Phil Taylor. When Phil couldn't find the type of bike he wanted, he decided to build one, and so his frame-building career began. But since that wasn't enough for the schoolteacher-turned-frame-builder, he wanted to share frame-building with the entire continent, so he started the UK's Bespoked Handmade Bike Show. Now in its eighth year, Bespoked has grown to become a most respectable showing of handmade bicycles and accessories, including exhibitors from as far away as the States, Spain, and Australia. Phil shares his perspective of how Bespoked is a bit different than NABS and what to expect when you show up in Bristol on April 20th. So let's begin with my conversation with Jim Sayer, from Adventure Cycling Association in Missoula, Montana.
Hi, Jim. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me, and always good to talk with you.
Yeah, and it's always good to catch up with what Adventure Cycling is doing and you. It's the beginning of the season. You know, I want to talk about some things you did last year. You had a really cool trip with one of your daughters, but let's first talk about the National Bike Summit since it just wrapped up last week. I know you were there. Give us some of the highlights of the event.
Well, I hadn't been to the summit for the last couple of years, just having conflicts. For example, we had the International Bike Summit last 2 years ago in Taiwan, Bella City. And then last year, as you said, I was with my daughter riding across the U.S. So I hadn't really seen it. And it's interesting, the summit has shrunk. And it's a little bit of an indicator of the national bike movement that we're just seeing some or less activity at national level right now. Really great energy. I think what's happened is that it shrunk down. League of American Bicyclists, which sponsors the event, was getting its bearings. And so getting back there and meeting with a lot of great people, doing wonderful projects at the local and state levels and at the national level was very exciting. So we enjoyed it greatly.
Are you saying that the actual summit itself was smaller in terms of attendance, or how about the number of breakout sessions? Do they still have a lot of that going on?
Well, overall, the summit has less participants than it did at its peak. In fact, I think we had around 400 this year. I think it got up to at least 900 at one point. I think what we're seeing in some ways is a little bit of devolution. People, pursuing things at the local level. We didn't see anybody or very few people from the bike industry at the summit. We also didn't see a lot of the major metropolitan groups, like from L.A. or San Francisco or New York City. Just people aren't attending for whatever their reasons are. And so I hope, and I said this when I gave a talk to one of the plenaries, I really hope we can bring the summit back up, because it's good to have a great gathering of the tribe, both for what we can do on Capitol Hill, but also what we can do for the bike movement by exchanging good ideas and really raising the energy level at the national level. Because as we all know, biking is going great at the local level. We're seeing so many people get involved participating in biking of all kinds.
I guess I have a devil's advocate kind of question. What do you see holding the National Bike Summit back? Because it was really energetic the last time I was there, and there was, people were just clamoring to get up on the hill and make their asks and do all that stuff.
Well, twofold. One is, I think the bike movement's a little more fragmented. I think that there are more conferences out there now. People for Bikes, which is the trade association for the bike industry, is holding its own conference now called Places for Bikes. You have just a bunch of different things going on throughout the year, so it does pull people in different directions. Another thing is that it's a little bit unclear how much we get at the national level. The federal government is still dispensing quite a bit of money towards bike and pedestrian investments. We'll see how that goes in the future. Nobody really knows where the current infrastructure proposal from the Trump administration is going. We heard a lot of negatives from both Republicans and Democrats on the funding mechanism, because what they're proposing, or what the administration is proposing, is basically to flip the funding allocation, where right now, basically, you get an 80% investment in your project from the federal government, 20% local. I think they want to flip that to where it's 20% federal, 80% local. I don't think a lot of local governments or state governments are going to go for that. So it's really unclear how far this proposal is going to move this year. We have till 2020 with the current transportation authorization, which does have dedicated bike ped support. But there's been a slow whittling away of that federal commitment, and we're going to keep fighting for that federal commitment in addition to local and state commitments for biking and walking. So unclear right now.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I think when you see a federal commitment beginning to dwindle, maybe you say, hey, I'm just going to stay home and work on my local government and maybe in my state level, too.
Well, I know when I go to shows like North American Handmade Bike Show or the Philly Bike Expo, or last year I went to the Builders Ball, local people were there and local people's advocacy organizations were there talking about what's going on locally. So I certainly see the energy there. And I hope that, you need to be able to get to those congressmen and women and senators too. So I know that's one of the big deals, is getting up on the Hill on Thursday and having an ask. What was your ask this year? Was there one in particular?
Well, we talked to them about the infrastructure bill, find out where they were at in general on the concepts that were being put out, because there is no bill.
Right.
They haven't actually delivered legislative language to Capitol Hill. So we heard a mix on that, both on the funding mechanism and then also on some of the aspects of dedicated funding. And then there was a ask for a bill on the Transportation Access and System Connection Act, the TASC Act, which is to try and bolster metropolitan areas' access to data. That could really make the case for why we should invest more in biking and walking, because they are so naturally suited to an urban environment, and we're seeing demand from all generations, boomers, millennials, everybody in between, to have more access to safe bike facilities so that you can commute or recreate by bike. So we think that the data will show that trends are in our favor in the biking world. So we asked them to co-sponsor that bill. And then we asked them for a number of more localized projects too that would benefit biking in our state. So good energy. I mean, we really had a great time, and it was fun to see new groups springing up at the state level, like the Nevada Bicycle Coalition, which is a new group that's sprung up to promote cycling there. And a lot of the other state groups are doing well, including in our home state of Montana. We have a great bike walk group at the state level, and that's important. And people should understand, and I say this at every presentation I make, is that if you can afford it, support your local groups. And most people do, because they're where the rubber meets the road, for sure. You know, that's where you see the potholes or the bike lanes, or you don't see them. But also national groups, and we get tremendous support. We're the largest cycling membership group in North America. We have 53,000 members. And then the state groups are super important, because they deal with the Departments of Transportation. And the Departments of Transportation are the ones that steer a lot of the funding, whether it's the federal money or their state money, like from the gas tax. And they also set a lot of the policies that matter to cyclists, whether it's on rumble strips or shoulder width or surface conditions, you know, chip seal, stuff like that out in the rural areas. The state Departments of Transportation are really important players. So having a strong state group, like a Bicycle Colorado, for example, or a Mass Bike in Massachusetts, really important. So if you can support the local, state, and national groups, go for it. If you can afford it, it's really important.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Jim Sayer. He is the executive director of Adventure Cycling, and those are all great ideas. I want to actually switch gears and talk about adventure cycling right now. It is, of course, as everybody knows, one of my favorite organizations. I've been involved with it for, oh man, going on 25 years. I'm wondering what's new for 2018. Actually, I know some of it because I did spend some time on the website this week. But tell our listeners, what's new for 2018? What are you doing?
There's a lot. You know, we've really grown over the last decade, as I mentioned, on our membership levels, but also we've now got 42 staff here at our headquarters in Missoula, Montana. And I encourage everybody to come out and visit us by bike, preferably. We're doing more of everything. We're running more tours with more participants. We just put out a month ago a new app that you can get on iTunes or Google Play, where you can now buy all of our routes and our maps online, which is great. That's a new thing for us. You can still get all of our maps in the old paper format. And we're encouraging people to do both because, frankly, you know, sometimes that battery dies or the phone or tablet breaks while you're on the road. So really up to you, but you can now get all of our maps, almost 47,000 miles of routes and maps online. The big news last year was we put out the Chicago to New York paved route with a couple of variations, which has been very popular. And then we have six cartographers, and they are working away right now to meet our deadline to get the 20th anniversary complete revamp of the Great Divide mountain bike route out to the public. So that's going to be super cool. It's 20 years ago this year that we issued the Great Divide mountain bike route, and we've expanded it, adding 400 miles. So now it will go deeper into Canada, all the way up to Jasper National Park, and run about 2,800 miles all the way to the Mexico-New Mexico border.
Wow. Wow. It's been 20 years?
20 years old. Yeah,
jeez.
It's kind of shocking. But yeah. So we're excited. It's a completely revamped map, too. It's really beautifully done in the same style as our Idaho Hot Springs mountain bike route that we issued a few years ago. And we're also doing research for a cool new gravel grinder route, 1,100 miles in northwest Arkansas. So that's going to be great. That'll come out next year. But we're doing the research on it this year. And then we'll get going on the cartography after we finish the Great Divide. So a lot going on that front. And then advocacy, we keep working on different states, as I mentioned, on everything from rumble strips to surfaces. But also, we have a bunch of cool partnerships. One is with Amtrak, where we've gotten them to do a lot more checked service, so you can roll your bike onto all their long-distance trains now without having to box them. We have a renewal of our partnership with the National Park Service. We've been working with them for 5 years on improving biking to and through the national parks. And then we also work with a lot of state parks because they're more and more interested in bike travel and tourism. Just this last week, Tennessee became, I think, the 8th or 9th state to have a no-turnaway policy, which means that when you go to a state park in Tennessee, And if the campgrounds are technically full in terms of camping, they will still accommodate any cyclist that pulls up there no matter when and provide you with space, even if they're technically full.
How cool is that?
Yeah, it's great. So you don't go to a campground where, you know, the next potential stop is 40 miles away,
right,
exhausted. So increasingly, we're seeing states do that. We keep working with them. And we put together best practices guides for both state parks and national parks on how to be better and more bike-friendly destinations. So that's exciting, too.
I saw on the website you have something called tour incentives. What are those?
Yeah. Well, that's for our own bike tours, and we run a lot of self-contained and supported bike tours all over the U.S. and Canada. And so if you go on more than one tour with us in a year, we'll give you a discount on one of those tours. If you bring a friend along, we have basically it's a 5 for $4 on our week-long tours where you would just pay for 4 tours for 5 people. So it's kind of nice. It's like almost like a 20% discount for everybody on our tours. And our tours, we're excited because we're going to run 106 tours and instructional courses this year.
Wow.
And that's more than ever for us. And we're expecting our highest level of participation. And they're usually small tours. Most of our tours are only for up to 14 people. We have some supported tours that have more. But it's a really rich experience. And they're both self-contained and van supported and fully supported. So you can check it out at adventurecycling.org/tours.
Well, I guess you answered my question as to how bicycle touring is going. It's obviously growing.
Yeah, and it's so great to see it across all demographics. We're seeing interest at state agencies, too. The one other advocacy project that I'll mention briefly is our U.S. Bicycle Route System project, which we do in partnership with state departments of transportation. And we now have 25 states, including Ohio, that have designated U.S. bicycle routes. These are official routes. And ideally, they sign them, they maintain them to the best standards for bicyclists. So this is going to be similar to what you see in Europe with what they call Eurovelo. It's an official network of bicycle routes. And wouldn't it be cool if we had 50,000 miles of signed designated routes all over the U.S. connecting all our major metropolitan areas, national parks, state parks. So we're the main advocacy group that works on that project. And so we are excited half the states in the nation plus D.C. have now designated those routes.
Yeah, I think that last year Ohio signed Route 50, is it?
It did.
Yeah.
We're looking to see Nevada may designate a U.S. bike Route 50 this spring, which is awesome. And then California may do it in the fall. So
cool.
It's really neat to see the interconnections between states, through an official bike project.
Right.
The one other project I wanted to mention is really fun. A lot of people say, what are the demographics of cycling? And definitely in commuting, we see all kinds of folks from young to older doing that. But we started a few years ago an award program for young adults to get them into bike travel.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, and we named it this last year after Greg Seipel, who was one of our founders, originally from Ohio, moved to Montana, and was one of the co-founders of Bike Centennial, now Adventure Cycling, and he retired last year. And in his honor, we named these awards that we've been running for 5 years after Greg. So they're the Greg Seipel Award for Young Adult Bicycle Travel. It's a mouthful, but we offer 4 awards, and we had 18 finalists out of 100 applicants do videos, and they were so fun to watch. They're just little 2-minute videos, and I'm hoping we're going to make some of them public so people can just enjoy them. But what they do is they get a leadership training course or an intro course for road touring from us, and also, in some cases, a new bike and gear. And in return, they become these cool ambassadors for bike travel with younger demographics, with all sorts of folks organizing tours, instructional courses of their own. So they tell us in advance what they're going to do. That's part of the application process. But it was so inspiring to see these amazing young folks become ambassadors for bicycle travel. And so we just are seeing a ton of energy in this area. So we're very excited. And we're actually working on a strategic plan for the next 5 years because we want to try and take advantage of that energy.
The ambassador program, the young adult ambassador program, is that open now for people for 2018?
No, we just announced the 4 winners, and we just released information on our blog and website about who the winners are with little profiles. But later this year, I think it'll begin around December, that we'll open the application process. So people, they do an application, and then we pick finalists, and then they submit a short video explaining why they want to do this. And again, we had way too many great applicants. That was the problem. We used to only do two of these awards. Now we're doing four. You know, we'll do more. It's another nice indicator of the enthusiasm for bicycle travel. And this is for people 18 to 30.
Yeah. And that's what I like to see, younger people coming into the sport, that it isn't just, you know, we old people.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Trust me, there are every demographic. There's every demographic involved in this. And it's really one of the great things about bicycling right now is you're seeing demand and interest from all generations. So I think the challenging part for bike groups is, do we have the right engagement models? That's what we're working through in our strategic plan. Do millennials want to join as regular members? Will they, as they get older, maybe hit their 30s, 40s, become members or not? Do they want to find a different way to engage with organizations? So that's the thing that we're working on right now. Our members, they are our bedrock. They help make the organization go in so many ways, not just giving money, but volunteering, doing a lot of other things. And one other way they get involved, and one other way the listeners on the show can get involved, is June 1st through 3rd, we're going to do the third annual bike travel weekend. And that's where we have up to 1,000 DIY events. People organize their own bike trips over that weekend. It's so great, you know, just to see the variety and ingenuity of these different trips. A lot of them are family trips, friend trips. But people do overnights of camping, indoor, whatever they want. But we had almost 1,000 last year in, I think, up to 20 countries. So that's June 1st through 3rd. We have more info on the website. But if you can get away for a bike trip of your own and you can invite others or just keep it your own, please join us, because Bike Travel Weekend, it's a great way to show people that people are out there traveling by bike.
So let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Jim Sayre. He is the executive director of Adventure Cycling, and we're going to flip it around one more time and talk about Jim and your daughter. We only have a couple minutes left, but I'd like you to tell us a little bit about your cross-country trip, because you posted some wonderful comments and photos, and the two of you looked like you had such a good time. And she, is she one of a twin?
Yeah, she is. Yeah, we have three daughters. And all of them have been involved in bike travel, whether they wanted to or not, just because of who I am and
right.
where I've worked.
Like they had a choice.
But I had hit my 12-year mark as director, and my board and staff were kind enough to let me go for 2.5 months. And she and I rode from my mom's house in Seal Beach, California, and we rode down, and it was her 80th birthday, and we rode down to San Diego about 100 miles and turned left. And then rode across the country on Adventure Cycling's Southern Tier route, which is a super cool route that goes through the Arizona desert, the Sonoran desert, goes all the way down through New Mexico, 1,100 miles across Eternal, Texas, through Austin.
I remember that.
Yeah, to New Orleans. And then we went along the Gulf Coast through Mississippi and Alabama, through the Florida Panhandle. And then we went to St. Augustine, Florida, and up to Jacksonville. So about 3,100 miles, yeah, about 9 weeks. And it was incredible. Lucy is now 19, but she was 18, and she had a gap semester. So I was really fortunate to have one of my three daughters with me for this truly amazing ride.
I followed it as you went across country, and I saw the thing that really impressed me, besides the fact that your daughter is just awesome, that she will just get out there and do it regardless, is that you took some time not only to get engaged with the people where you stopped and who you ran into on a day-to-day basis, but you also took some contemplative time and you posted some of that stuff. And I thought it was just such a beautiful sort of travelogue as you went along.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it is amazing. And you know, everybody asked me, well, how? What did you think of it? And I'd heard so many stories about the transformative effects. And it is. It's a great way to get out. Biking is probably the most sensuous, amazing way to travel, of any kind of travel, because you can cover a decent amount of terrain and you can see so much and you feel so much. And people are so kind to you. It's amazing. The bike is really the friendliest vehicle ever created to travel. And so we had an amazing time meeting people. And also in this time of political division, again, you see so many communities and people where everybody is the same. And regardless of how you feel about politics, people are good to each other. So we had an amazing time. I really encourage people to get out there. It was really good after advocating for long long-distance bike travel to actually get out there and make sure I was telling the truth. It was really amazing. I can't emphasize how much. And the nice thing about Southern Tier, it's a little shorter, 3,100 miles. Our other cross-country routes that adventure cycling, the Trans Am and Northern Tier, about 4,200 miles.
Right.
And you can also use our bicycle route 66, which came out a couple of years ago. And that now connects to that new Chicago to New York route. So you could use that too, but it's about 4,000. So Southern Tier is a way to get across pretty quickly. Cool cultures, cities, places to see. It's amazing.
Yeah. So do you have anything big planned for 2018, or are you like cooling out a little bit this year?
No, we got to get this damn strategic plan done because,
right,
as I said, we have so many opportunities and we do need to shift some things. There's so much happening in the digital sphere. So we're seeing how that will affect our map sales and projects. And then we'll also see, our magazine is paper and members love it. But, you know, again, the digital realm will be different. And we're going to probably do a lot more in-person connection. A lot of our members have asked to meet each other and connect, like, through this bike travel weekend. So,
oh, a bike dating app.
Yeah, there could be that, or just other ways that people can do it through more interactive forums. But also a lot more in-person rides, like bike travel weekend every weekend, or at least more weekends. So I'm really excited about it. We've got this great feedback from members, and I think the future is really bright.
Well, I will say the magazine looks beautiful.
Well, thank you.
I like you know, I'm a print person, but I mean, I look at web all day long, but I really do love Adventure Cycling Magazine. It's so beautiful.
Thank you. Well, we're fortunate because of all the things in the print realm, specialty magazines seem to be holding their own, especially if you've got a popular subject. And we think bike travel is awesome.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me today. Again, Jim Sayer, Executive Director of the Adventure Cycling Association. It's adventurecycling.org. And it's, you know, like, grab a cup of coffee and take some time because you can find out a lot of stuff on that website. Thanks so much, Jim.
Yeah, thank you, Diane. Have a great spring.
Oh, when it gets here, I will. Thanks. Alrighty, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Jim Sayer joined me from the offices of Adventure Cycling in Missoula, Montana. I really enjoy how articulate he is on all these cycling-related topics. You can find out more about the organization at adventurecycling.org. So let's take a break, and then it's off to England to speak with Phil Taylor from Bespoked, the handmade show in the UK. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
Back, and here is my conversation with Phil Taylor. I think you'll enjoy it. Hello, Phil. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today.
Hello, Diane.
Well, how's England this morning? Well, actually, for you, it's afternoon, huh?
It's just turned off. A bit grey, and maybe we're expecting a little bit more snow.
Oh, welcome to my world.
It seems to sort of turn daily from spring to winter, and there's nothing sort of in between.
Yeah, we are waiting anxiously here for spring. I want to talk to you about your history and, of course, the show coming up in April, Bespoke, in Bristol. Tell us a little bit about Phil's history as a frame builder.
So I suppose I started building frames sort of hand in hand with the start of the show. The two kind of went together. I used to sort of cycle. Well, I cycled a lot, and I realised that there wasn't a bike that I wanted, which I suppose was a gravel bike. But this is going back probably about 10 years, and there was cross bikes and there was mountain bikes, and I was commuting 15 miles each way a day, and there were some good hills I could go over. but sometimes I wanted a fast bike to ride a bit faster on the road. So there wasn't really much about. So I started thinking about, well, I could build myself something. So I learned how to weld. I went to a sort of went and did a welding, a TIG welding course, and became sort of, I suppose, a qualified welder. And then I was still teaching at a school. And then sort of by researching, looking around, I sort of kept getting drawn to custom frame builders, but to NABS, and seeing all the builders there and everything that they were doing. And my wife, I'm going off why I was a frame builder, but going more into the start of the show here. But I noticed that my wife and I had set up Brighton Art Fair, an art fair for artists based in Brighton. So there was a lot big art community, but there wasn't a show for them. So we had experience of setting up a show. So we started up Bespoked, and I suppose took it from there. And my frame building, I suppose, went hand in hand in that I got in contact with a lot of different builders and used to go and see them. And we used to make, well, the films we make for Bespoke, I've completely forgotten what they're called.
Oh, the videos?
Yeah, the videos that we did. Meet the Maker was sort of partly my interest in going to see people and partly to sort of show people, I think, what the effort that goes into making a handmade bicycle, because they don't appear overnight.
Right, no kidding.
It takes quite a long time, and just to, I suppose, to try and show people everything that goes into making a bicycle and how it's one person often in a relatively small workshop beavering away.
Did you actually come over to the States and go to any of the NABS shows?
No, I've never been to NABS, so yeah.
Well, looking at your video, I guess there's a 4-minute-plus video on the maybe the homepage.
Yeah.
It looks a lot, except for the venue, it looks a lot like it does here in the States. You know, so okay. Yeah. Yeah, we've been to maybe 5 or 6 of them, and yeah, they frame builders show up, people show up. How different do you think Bespoke is from the NABS show, or do you see any differences? England, of course, has a whole slew of different builders, although some tend to come over to the States to exhibit. I assume some come from the States to Bespoke, too.
Yes, yeah. Not having been to NABS, I can't sort of say, I can't compare the two from directly going there. I can just, I suppose, say from what I've seen and what I've heard other people sort of say. And I think, looking at photos and a lot of images, I think NABS, there seems to be lots of show bikes. People build a bike specifically maybe for the show.
Yes, I believe that's true.
Yeah, and I think that has been the case here. But I think a lot of people haven't maybe got the budget or the time. So they're often customer bikes that are on display. So don't get me wrong, some people do build show bikes. But on the whole, they're customer bikes that have been borrowed back that are on display. So it's their bicycles that I see at NABS sometimes are a bit more, it's extravagant, maybe the word, showcases rather than the actual bikes that people ride.
That's an interesting point. I know that occasionally a builder here will have a bike that was already purchased by a customer, but it hasn't been out on the road yet. So it's what you're saying is, people are bringing in bikes that have already been built and ridden, and then they're showing them off, which I think has some merit in some ways. I like that. I actually like that.
Whenever I try and clean my bicycle, I can never get it properly clean.
Yeah, right.
But the bikes that are often shown do look as if they're new. They look as if they haven't been ridden, which I don't quite know how that happens.
Yeah, well, because some people are just more anal about that than others, right?
I think that must be it. Yeah, yeah. As long as the wheels go around, that's clean enough for me.
Right. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Phil Taylor. He is the founder of the Bespoked Handmade Show in England. How many exhibitors do you have this year?
We have about 100. There's 88 stands, but there's about 100 exhibitors. Some people share, and there's a couple of builders, I suppose, who distribute other people's brands.
You have a really interesting venue. It's a beautiful building. What is that?
It's part of the old Bristol train station, and it was designed by Eisenbahn Kingdom Brunel. So he's sort of an engineering legend, especially around the West Country. He designed the Clifton Suspension Bridge, shipping canal tunnels, a lot of the stuff. I can't remember the dates. But yeah, he designed the building. So it's of historical significance, and it's part of the current Bristol train station. So it's an ideal place because people can sort of fall off the train from London and sort of right into Bespoke.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
The engineering significance is still there.
Yeah, we went to the New England Builders Ball last year, and it was in this kind of iconic building in Boston up on the waterfront. So that it's interesting to have those venues rather than just a big cold convention center. I like that. That's really cool. So are there specific categories at your show that like there are at NABS, or are they just, it's just here are the bikes?
It's just here are the bikes. And so at NABS, are there categories that people, is this for awards or that they enter the bikes tour, or do you walk around the show and see different categories of bike?
They do that. There are specific judges who walk around, and then there's a People's Choice Award that I think comes after the show closes. People vote on them online or something like that.
Yeah, we've thought long and hard about the awards and how, I suppose when we first started, it was almost looking at what NABS did and let's try and do the same, but with not quite as many. Listening to the feedback from exhibitors, we've changed the awards, and I think having sort of best of a category, so best road bike, best gravel bike, best mountain bike, it maybe can mislead, because I felt that the word best is quite an objective statement. This is the best mountain bike at the show, where it might be the best bike for the person who's ordered it, but it's a subjective choice if you've got a judge. The judge hasn't ridden the bike. They might not even know the full criteria. So to I suppose, recognise the subjectivity of a judge choosing an award, what we've done is we've asked leading magazines and media to come and them to select their favourite bike, so it's their choice. And to, I think the word choice or favourite, I suppose, recognises it's the subjectivity of that choice.
I like that.
And the awards that we've got this year, where judges are going to actually be looking at them and choosing the bike, are technical excellence. So it's something that a judge, someone who knows what they're talking about, it's a frame build, look around and see.
Okay, we lost you for I lost you for a second. So you started saying something about judges.
That was my best stuff then. That was all the greatest stuff I think I've ever said.
It was only 4 or 5 seconds. Stop it.
But I can cram a lot into 4 or 5 seconds.
I'm leaving this in. It's just too funny. Go ahead.
So whereabouts?
Talking about the judges and how your system works and the subjectivity.
Yeah, and I think it's to recognise that subjectivity by allowing by changing the name and allowing certain magazines, print magazines, to come along and choose their favourite bikes within a certain category. So we've asked cyclists who are a road cycling magazine to come along and choose their favourite bikes. And I think that identifies that actually the thing to do is to come along here and choose your favourite. So that if, as I was saying, there's customers' bikes on display, each customer's bike is their favourite, is best for them. So in terms of, I suppose, best touring bike, the touring bike that's been made for a particular person, for a particular purpose, is the best for them. So to have an award that says this is the best touring bike at the show is not necessarily reflective of what else there is there.
Yeah, I like that.
And there's been talk about whether we should have awards or not. And we ask the exhibitors for feedback, and yes, they do want the awards, but I think it's getting them to be fair, and to make it fair, it would turn it into an award show where you'd have to have so much time and resources dedicated to riding the bikes. And as I say, to ride the bike and to test it, unless you're the person who's commissioned it, then it's not a fair test.
Yep, I absolutely agree. I think that's a really interesting way of looking at it. You know, I had a question about how big the handmade or custom bike building business is in the UK. You know, it's sort of, since NABS, it's kind of exploded here in the States. And I'm just wondering how many, and I mean, this is sort of one of those, who knows how many, but how many builders, or better question maybe is, Have you seen an increase in hand builders in the recent past?
Yes, we have. And I suppose from a show organizer, it's how sustainable is it? And I talk with frame builders daily. I run my own workshop, so I get to see how many orders I get. So I see how, you know, is it a sustainable way of living? It's not my sole income. There's a constant rotation, I think, of builders. And I think to do it and to make a full-time living out of it, it's not easy. It takes dedication and something special. I think in terms of custom builders, a lot of the builders now are recognising that to have an off-the-peg model that they can maybe still make that is a number of different sizes, that they worked out that 90% of their customers come to them wanting quite similar specifications on a bike, to make that kind of bicycle into a model, to sell it in a fairly limited number of off-the-peg sizes can actually help support them to do the custom stuff which they like, which might not actually always be that cost beneficial to do. There's people I've known that are working, they've got full order books, but they can almost not pay the bills.
Yes, I am aware of what you're saying.
Yeah, they might have the work, but maybe it's that they can't charge. It's a difficult one, I think, because they can't charge what its true value is, because it's a bicycle at the end of the day, and it's in a marketplace where there are bicycles of you can get a good bike for £1,000.
Right.
And to actually charge £10,000, it's a lot more money. It's on the same continuum. It's when I say it's still a bicycle, it's not to sort of take away. When an artisan and a craftsman makes a bicycle and it takes them a month to make, to actually charge for every penny of that, it would make it almost too expensive.
Right.
So whether it's the market has to change, and I suppose reading on forums when people that don't understand the amount of work that goes into it see the price, there's always those fairly negative comments on forums at how much that is and, you know, why should it cost that much? But to actually know that the person is probably working on the minimum wage, by the time you've taken in all the time for everything, it shows that no one's really getting rich from making any handmade bicycles.
So true. You know it from experience. I see it being on, you know, sort of the outside of it, looking in after having been in a retail environment for over 40 years and going from selling production bikes to a handmade custom model, even though it wasn't our frame. You know, we were having frame builders build frames for us. So, yes, I can see. And there's only a limited market for those super, super high-end custom bikes.
Yes. Yeah. It is a limited market. And I think that's where shows like ours and NABS work well, because we get sort of emails from people telling us, I suppose, how we should run the show. And, you know, you need to get more people in. This is from visitors saying, get more people in so that make sure the door price is free. I think it does a disservice to those people, the exhibitors, and to those that are really serious about buying something, because they need time to have a meaningful conversation with the builder.
Right.
But the customers, people don't walk into a show like ours with £5,000, £10,000 in their pocket to buy a bicycle, but on the off chance. They don't stumble across it. I'll come into the show, it's free, we'll go in on a wet afternoon. It'll be a good place to take the kids. There's, you know, we're going to Bespoked. Oh, have a look around. There's a bike for £5,000. Oh, I've always fancied a bike. I'll buy it. Our shows get a level of people that are educated. They know what they're looking at.
Right.
They know what to expect. And the frame builders can have meaningful conversations. And to have, I don't know, to have maybe 10 meaningful conversations a day rather than to have 20, 30 conversations explaining why their bike costs 5 times, 10 times the price of one in the local bike shop.
Yeah, when they're taking up all your time asking why the bike is so expensive instead of taking up your time talking about, well, what do I want from my custom bike, which is the right conversation to have there, right?
Yes, yeah.
So when is the show?
The show is the 20th to the 22nd of April.
Are you expecting people to come from out of the Bristol area, out of England?
Yes, yeah. I mean, we've already sold tickets to people come from Japan. Quite a few people come from the States.
Wow.
From Italy, Australia. So, yeah, it's people come from all over the world.
How can my listeners find out more about Bespoke? What is the website?
Have a look on the website, which is www.bespoked.cc. That's I can't even spell my own company name.
I think we can figure it out. We have educated listeners too. That's hilarious. Well, yeah. I hope you have a wonderful show this year. Maybe it'll stop raining or snowing or whatever.
There's always good weather for Bespoke. It's spring sprung last year on the show. It was tropical.
Oh, you know what? That's awesome. I hope that happens to you again this year. Well, Phil, thank you so much for talking with me today. Good luck with the show. We will put all the information up on our Facebook page, and I'll be watching for some of the videos that come down this year. Those are interesting. One of the things I really liked about your website were all the videos.
Right. Thank you very much, Diane. Good to speak to you.
You have a wonderful day.
And you too.
Okay.
Thank you. Good to speak to you.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Phil Taylor joined me from his home in England, and you can find out more about the Bespoked Handmade Show at bespoked.cc. The website has some really cool videos that'll whet your appetite for what's going on in England with handmade bikes. I'd like to thank Jim Sayre from Adventure Cycling and Phil Taylor for being my guests this week. We will be back next week with a brand new show, including a conversation with Joe Nocella of 718 Cyclery in Brooklyn, New York. It's a very interesting retail model. Thank you for listening. If you enjoy our show, please go out to your podcast app and write a review or just give us a rating, hopefully a good one. You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at Outspoken Cyclist without an E. Stay safe out there, have a great week, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening. Ride safely, and we'll see you next week.